Hello and welcome to the True Faith Podcast. This is the second in a special series of podcasts we've got going on with the Newcastle United Foundation. If you haven't listened to the first one already, go back and listen to it. It's part of the free shows, so it's available on all your podcast apps. So this week I am joined again by Ashley from the Foundation. Hello, Ashley.
Hi, Mickey.
And I'm also joined by Les as well.
Hello, mate. All right.
So first of all, Ashley, for anyone that didn't listen to the first podcast, can you just tell us a bit about yourself and the programme with the Foundation?
Yeah, so I am the Health and Wellbeing Manager at the Newcastle United Foundation. We've recently launched a mental health campaign for the fans. So the campaign's called Be a Game Changer. It's all about raising awareness of mental health. We really want to encourage fans to talk more, just like you would about your physical health. We want to share loads of information on how you can stay fit and well, both physically and mentally. We've got a dedicated Facebook group, so you can search for Be a Game Changer on Facebook and join that. We're sharing loads of real life stories, and we're also signposting people to support. So if you do need support for yourself or a friend, we've got the services in the local area that you can access.
Cool, and could you just tell us a bit about what's been going on recently and what have you got planned for the summer?
Yes, so we've been sharing loads of content online. We've been in quite a few newspaper articles, on the radio, obviously done the podcast. The plans for the summer are basically to carry on growing our Facebook group, so please do join. But also we're going to be running some walk and football tournaments, so people can get involved in that. We've always got walk and football and running groups that people can access, because we all know, you know, exercise is great for your mental health as well as your physical health. And there's going to be loads of stuff happening this week, with it being Mental Health Awareness Week, and some other stuff. So stay tuned, keep your eyes peeled, and there'll be loads of stuff coming up that people can get involved with.
So follow the Foundation on Twitter. We'll share everything as well through our social media channels, and everything will be in links at the bottom of this podcast. Just one final question for you, actually, before I crack on. What was it like doing the show with Alan Robson?
Yes, it was really good. So I was on Night Owls with Alan Robson. So, you know, check that out, have a little listen. No, it was really good, really nice guy. So he's invited us back to share the messages so we can get that out as well as obviously coming on here. So really pleased to be on True Faith, and it was great to be on Night Owls as well.
Was he as funny in real life as he seems on the radio?
Yeah, he was class. He was a lovely bloke.
I'd love to meet him, by the way. Alan, if you're listening, you're probably not, but if you are, we'd love to have you on the show. So the purpose of this podcast this week is we're going to listen to Les's story. So Les, thank you very much for joining us and for sharing your story with us today. Could you just start by giving us a bit of background about your past and your story up to the point of realising you needed some help?
Yeah, sure. I would think it probably started when I was little, really, probably around high school age, 12 or 13. My dad had a very good job and I always had nice things. I was very much a spoiled child. And he was working away and had an accident where he was nearly killed. And that was obviously a bit of a shock and a bit of a trauma. But then it was going from being spoiled and having nice things and mega drives and nice trainers and like Brazilian Ronaldo football boots for Christmas, to wearing second-hand clothes for school, to having to get free school meals, which again, obviously now I know that at the time there's nothing wrong with that, but back then it was like a bit of a stigma, or sometimes having to have packed lunches, or sometimes not even having anything to eat, having to walk to school, having to sell my bus pass to other kids to, just for the sake of being able to have stuff. So that was probably the first setback. And then growing up, I was a DJ from when I was probably 14, when I'd done the BTEC DJ thing, which was basically a community effort to get kids off the streets. And I'd done that, and then I used to DJ at under 18s nights in Middlesbrough and in Newcastle and in Hartlepool. And then I kind of progressed from there, really, to a point where I was, by the time I finished DJing, I was winning awards, I was opening nightclubs in Newcastle, I was, you know, being asked to fly overseas. And it was good, making a lot of money, and really, really enjoying myself. But in between that, when you go through the things and you go through life and you have your first breakup with girlfriends, or like you have your first fight, or you have, don't know, just little things that just niggle you and you think, oh, well, this is really what life's about. And then for me, the big one at the time, which I didn't realise, and it's only realising now, was obviously being being abused in my mid-teens, which at the time you don't really think that that's what it is, but it comes out and it turns out that's what it was. And you think, wow, that's pretty naughty, that, like, and I've dealt with that. But I kind of, going through life, obviously, you bury your head in the sand a bit and you don't think things have really happened. And then you do your best and then you want more, so you feel better. And for me, it was the DJing, and it was more fame. And then I went into stand-up, and I was doing like university tours, and I was DJing like 4,000 people a weekend. And bear in mind, I was only working one night a week, which is, you know, a lot of people, and it was a real buzz. And you don't really feel anything because you're surrounded by loads of people all the time, and you're partying really hard, you're drinking loads, you're taking stuff to stay awake, you're taking stuff to go to sleep, you know, you're seeing loads of different women, you're always in loads of different cities, and it was just wild and exhausting. And as I slowly started to come out of that, I had less and less people in there, that's when you start to realise I'm actually a little bit lonely. I was married, I had two young children, and then going through that, and then me and her had a bit of a rough patch. And then the biggest one, that was my biggest setback at the time, was obviously breaking up with my wife, losing my two children. And that obviously sent us back to the drink, it sent us back to partying really hard, it sent us back to, you know, womanising again, it sent us back to just being a bit wild and leery, really, just to take the edge off it. And then I thought, right, because I was at university at the time as a mature student, I thought, right, I'm really going to dig in, I'm going to get myself an awesome job, I'll travel the world, it'll take us away from everything. So I dug in at uni, I made a few contacts when I was working away, because I went and worked as a contractor for an oil company for a little while. And I met a guy who had a service company, and it was an obscene job. It was amazing. It was back to back hours, which basically meant if I worked a fortnight away, I got a fortnight off. If I'd done a month away, I got a month off. I'd only worked 6 months of the year, and the salary was very, very good. Now, bearing in mind, at this point, I went through being a really spoiled child and having loads of nice things, to then having nothing, to then have my wife leave us and having nothing, to then thinking, I know what'll fix it, buying everything. And that's what I need. I need to travel the world, and I need to have loads of money, and I'll be all right. And then I had a motorbike accident 3 days before my final exams at uni, and a week before I was supposed to fly offshore, and I never went. So on top of the incident with my dad being abused, my wife leaving us, realising I don't actually have many friends, it was all part of a scene and people wanted something from me, to then losing the one thing that I thought was going to be my golden ticket away from it all, that's pretty much when my head imploded. And I realised that actually now I am not very happy with things. But back then I didn't know that's what it was. I didn't know it was depression. And it was only through, because obviously the motorbike accident, I had to go for a MRI on my hand from the damage I had in my hand, and had a panic attack over the needles in the centres for a psychological assessment. And that's when it come out, went, oh, you're not mental, you're severely depressed. I was like, well, right, okay.
Right, so that's kind of the point where you realised that there was an issue and thought it was the point to tackle it. I'm interested to know, like, during all those experiences you've had, whether you've had any of the kind of feelings that are typical or stereotypical to men that are struggling with their mental health. So, you know, some of the things that you've said there, where you've thought that you didn't need help, or maybe you've deflected from it by getting too involved in other stuff, you know. Mm. Which of those feelings have you had, and how do you kind of point to other men that are having the same feelings, what to do?
I had them both, mate, to be honest. I buried my head in the sand and thought, nah, I'm all right. And I would go from one vice to another to feel all right, because I had this big gaping hole inside of us which just wanted us to cry and disappear and curl into a ball. I couldn't get out of bed, I couldn't get ready. I was very demotivated. I had no drive, I had no interest, I had no passion. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't take care of my personal appearance. And I didn't know what it was. I just felt flat, and I felt like I couldn't be bothered. The biggest thing was, obviously, I had two young kids. I had people who looked up to us. I had a bit of a reputation just for being like Mr. Popular. And I didn't want people to think that I wasn't. And that's, again, you try and front it out and you tell yourself, no, I'm all right. I'll be all right. Very much a stiff upper lip kind of approach. Don't talk about it. Don't think about it. It'll all be all right. but it wasn't. And that they were probably the key symptoms, to be fair, that if I'd have known they were the symptoms of depression at the time, so the being lethargic, not being able to sleep, not having any interest, not being able to get out of bed, not being able to get dressed, not wanting to brush my hair, not wanting to put any hair gel on, not even wanting to spend time with anybody. That's when you realise and you think, oh, there's something not right. And if someone had said to me at the time where, you know, Les, these things aren't really ideal, you should probably look at talking to someone. Even back then, I'd have went, no, I'm fine, don't worry about it. I'm not going to the doctors. I don't need help. I don't need medication. I don't need therapy. And I think that's the biggest thing for me, is if you see it and you think you're all right and you haven't to tell yourself, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm just stressed, I'm fine, then maybe you should go to talk to somebody about it. That's the big one, like.
Yeah. So was it that moment where the lady told you that you had sort of severe depression? Was that the moment where you decided to seek help? And how did you do it?
Mate, it wasn't even a case of, like, seeking help. It was like, nah, I'm not. You might think I do. You might think I do, but I'm different. I'm all right. And it was for, quite literally, mate, I went to my CBT therapy for a year. Never made any progress at all. None. Because I didn't know what was going on. My mood was so cyclic and I was so erratic. I couldn't make any progress because I would be okay for 2 or 3 days. And then totally crash and not even want to open my eyes. I'd go to bed thinking I don't want to wake up in the morning. And I just thought that was because I was tired or I was run down. And when I realised I needed help, because I refused antidepressant medication, was I wasn't allowed my children Christmas Eve for the last 4 or 5 years since we were divorced. And we had a big argument about it. And then all of a sudden, my ex-wife says, you can have the kids for Christmas Eve. So I had them the 23rd, 24th, 25th. Went home 25th night. And when I went home, my new missus was upstairs. The kids had gone home and I was sat downstairs, mortal on the sofa. And just this little voice in my head started niggling, saying, I should go in the garage and hang yourself. That's what you should do. You should go and hang yourself in the garage. Now, this has happened before. I'd managed to get Jamal Lascelles' shirt for my son for his birthday. I took him at the training ground. He wrote to Jamal Lascelles at the stadium and sent him a birthday invitation. And Jamal said to me, he says, look, if you make a sign or a banner, I'll give you my shirt for your birthday. So, Chelsea game, end of last season. We've seen Jamal Lascelles as he's coming in. He says, yeah, I'll come and find you. We've beat Chelsea 3-0. Jamal Lascelles is doing the parade with his partner. He's took his captain's armband off. He's gave it to his wife. He's took his shirt off, walked over. He's gave it to the little one. It's soaking wet, stinks of sweat, quite literally dripping. The little ones fell asleep in the car holding it on the way home. His brother wasn't allowed to touch it. I wasn't allowed to touch it. And it was in a frame on his bedroom wall. And again, I dropped them off after getting the shirt. And this little voice in my head was going, oh, you're never going to top this. You're never going to do anything better than this. You might as well kill yourself now. You'll never top that. You're only going to disappoint them from here. And I just froze. I was lying in bed crying. I couldn't move. I didn't know if I had a panic attack, an anxiety attack, or was it me prehistoric mind, my reptilian brain, it took over and froze so to keep us safe. But going back to the Christmas, which has just gone, just that didn't stop this time. And I was in the garage and I was on a ladder and I had a rope around my neck and someone knocked at the door and the dog barked and I snapped out of it. So someone had a knock on my door and the dog had a bark, I don't know what would have happened. And that's when I realised this is scary, this, like, because next time, there might not be next time, you might end up dead. Yeah. And that's when I told my therapist that I didn't tell her what happened because I was scared I'd get sectioned. And she says, right, well, we're gonna look for medication for you. And I started the medication. And I got better. Obviously, the side effects weren't great from the first lot. Especially being a man, some of the side effects really didn't help. But the new ones that I'm on now, I feel all right. I feel pretty good. I'm just, like, I still get, obviously, angry with stuff. And I still get sad about stuff. But I feel my emotional range is very normal. Or what you would describe as normal anyway.
Yeah, that's really positive. What since then, what changes have you made in your life to kind of managing mental health better? And which of those would you recommend to anyone else?
Just talk to people, and you've got to accept when there's something not right. If you feel worked up, or you feel sad, or you feel angry, or there's something being niggling at you, don't bottle it up. You've got to talk about it. Even if it's a case of you feel like you're bothering people, or you feel like you're moaning on or ranting on. If you're upsetting someone or you're annoying them, they'll tell you. Don't bottle things up. You need to talk about things. That's the biggest thing I do, is actually accepting and acknowledging and telling people I'm not okay. I started a new job in the new year. Obviously, I've had depression for a long time. Now I know what it is. But I've never once since my diagnosis told anybody until I started this new job. When I got my medication, the doctors, the therapist said, right, you need to start owning this, because you're never going to get better if you leave it to me to sort out. She went, so you go and get your meds, you pay for your meds, and you take your meds, and you tell anybody who asks if you want to when you feel comfortable. So the biggest thing, and I absolutely shit myself having to tell my new boss, oh, by the way, do you know this new hire you've just taken on who's like really, really good, and you've recruited him from somewhere, and yeah, he's like severely depressed, nearly killed himself. Like for me, sitting there, because that's the other thing that depression does, it makes you really, really scared to tell people, because it also, you do this thing called, you ruminate on stuff, and you think really bad stuff's going to happen, then the anxiety kicks in. So my new boss was absolutely fine. He says, mate, anything you need at all, just tell us. I've never been in this situation, so if I can help you in any way, shape or form, I will. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, oh, but he's just saying that, and he's going to be watching us now, and am I going to get through my probation? And again, that all comes from the depression. So the big change I've made is accepting that I'm not very well. Other thing, obviously, I'm trying to eat well, started barbecuing. I'm always cooking stuff on a barbecue, like getting a new hobby, trying to exercise when I can, but it's difficult because my knee's knackered and obviously my hand's knackered. But getting out and about, spending time with people I like, when I get stressed, just take 5 minutes. And again, it sounds very cliche, but we do this thing now in therapy called mindfulness, where you actually just stop and you think, well, how do I actually feel? And why do I feel like this then? Right, so what's the cause of that? And what can we do to change it? Can we change? Do we need a break? What can we do? And instead of flying off the handle all the time, I've been in one for hours, which is what I used to do. I might be a little bit annoyed for like 15, 20 minutes, which has gone completely the other way from where I was.
Yeah.
As opposed to sit and cry in bed for hours, not being able to get up. I got dressed. I wanted to not wake up when I go to bed. I'm thinking, right, well, why do you feel like this? Right, well, you're depressed. Well, what's upset you? What do we need to do to change it? Who do we need to talk to feel better? Do we need something to eat? You know, and it's just those little bits. It's just trying to be more aware of how you're feeling yourself and get rid of that stiff upper lip bollocks, because that's nonsense, that. Nonsense. We're told from being young people, nah, we don't cry. We don't show any emotion. We don't show any of that stuff. And that's why people, like, quite literally explode or break down. You've got to tell people how you feel. Because, like, if you had a metal beam and you could see the stresses in the metal beam, you wouldn't keep stressing the metal beam, or it's going to break and your house is going to fall down. So people aren't any different. People can only take so much, and if you don't tell people, then you've got a lot of stuff to sort out on your own.
Yeah, that's a really simplistic way to put it, but it's absolutely spot on with the metal beam. That's
right.
That's brilliant. So I understand you've taken up football coaching.
Yeah, I've coached football probably about 3 years now, and again, it was when I was just feeling really low and lonely, and I didn't really know what to do. My little ones at the time were getting into football. The oldest one had been playing, and the little one was coming through, and I started coaching on the just the kiddie soccer camp, and then I took on a team at under sevens and under eights, and then I was helping the older one. I've done my level one with the first one, where you're pretty much a dad in a tracksuit. And I've done my level two, and I'm nearly at the back end of that.
Nice.
So, I enjoy my coaching. That's how I ended up getting in contact with Ashley, because I've been speaking to, obviously, the football coaching side, and I know a few of the guys who obviously coach my little ones, and looking at seeing if there was any ad hoc work there. So that's how I ended up in touch with Steve, who then ended up having a conversation and put us in touch with Ashley.
Right, so how are the teams doing? Are you still involved?
The flying, the little ones are very, very good, actually. They're not winning everything, but they're showing great fight. I've got a lot of little ones, kids who would look at you and go, they're not seven, they're like four or five. Right. Teeny tiny, but very, very talented. And there'll come a point where they hit a growth spurt and they can keep up with the other kids, because now they just get muscled and bumped off the ball. But the flying and the good kids. I've just taken over another team. My youngest son was in one of the first teams somewhere, and his coach left and I was asked to take over there. And again, you've got kids who were either messing about or being naughty or were just hard work. Even the space of 3 or 4 weeks, just by having a laugh with them and treating them like normal people and having a bit of crack with them, they're flying as well. And it's not just the football, it's like the personalities, the way they behave, the way they're behaving at home. And just, they're all good kids and they're all doing really well. And you can see them like develop and grow as people and footballers. It's really good, I enjoy it.
Yeah, and how do you think that's helped you?
It's, well, at first, it gives a purpose. I had to get out of the house. I had to get dressed. I had to go and run about. I had to exercise. But now, it sounds bonkers to say, but I've got a load of friends who are like at the same mentality as me. And I don't know whether that makes me sound really strange that I've got the mentality of a 5 or 6 year old. But they just love having a laugh. They love playing football. They love cracking jokes. They're just entertaining to be around. And I like it, mate. I look forward to going and coaching football. Because then you see the mums and dads and you have a bit of crack and you make new friends and then you're planning away for tournaments for obviously the summer and stuff. It's good, I enjoyed it. And again, I'm not saying if you're feeling really sad and low, go out and be a football coach. But go and find something that you might enjoy doing or might give you a bit of interaction with other people or might push you into doing something you wouldn't normally do.
That's brilliant. It's inspiring. And since you've linked up with the guys at the foundation, which has come through the coaching, how has that been for you, and why do you think the Be a Game Changer campaign is so important?
It's been really good, to be fair. And it's quite impressive because when you look at the foundation as a whole, I didn't really know what they did. I thought it was very much football schools or teaching kids PE. But the fact that they're doing this and they actually are taking in like a drive, because I've never seen anyone else about men's mental health nationally, never mind in the Northeast. And it's just it's good that there's someone actually taking an interest, and they've worked out what the target audience and the target demographic is really, because obviously you do get mums and children going to football, but it is mainly men. And I think it's an ideal place to raise the awareness of it. I really, really do. And especially when you look at what's going on at the club at the minute as well and all those other little bits and pieces, this is one thing the club can actually say, yeah, do you know what? We might have all that going on, but look, we're trying to make a massive difference here. And it is working as well, because obviously you've got my story, you've got the other guys, you've got people I've spoken to about it, people who'll be listening to this. And even if one person comes forward and says, do you know what? I'm really not well. And that one person gets better. It's a lot better than where it was before it started.
Definitely, and you're absolutely spot on. It's something that we're going to be massively proud of in the Northeast, that we're leading on this, I think, by the sounds of it, actually, hopefully. Can you just give us your final messaging, and then Les, I want to leave the last word in the podcast to you, if you don't mind, just as your final pointer for anyone else. So, over to you, actually.
Yeah, I just want to say a massive thank you to Les for sharing his story. It's really inspiring, and like you said, if this can help even one person, that's, you know, we've done our job with this campaign. So if anyone has been affected by anything that Les has said, or you might have noticed sort of symptoms within yourself, I would really encourage you to go to the website. So Be a Game Changer on the Newcastle United Foundation website, join the Facebook group, and like I said, there's information on where you can go for support if you do need it. So thank you.
And final message, Les, anyone else that's thinking anything like what you have?
I was at a point before I realised I was probably where I wanted to die and I didn't want to wake up. And it was really, really hard. And I know there's people who do feel like that. But I managed to live with it and get through it and cope with it. And I ain't the strongest person. I'm not the most strongest willed person. And if I can do it and I can live with it and I can get through it, then you can as well. You just need to ask for help.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Les. It's been absolutely brilliant. We'll be back with you with some more specials with the foundation over the next few months, so keep your eyes peeled for those. And as I say, all of the links to all of the programs and everything will be in tweets and at the bottom of this podcast, and also follow the foundation on Twitter. Thanks for listening.